Well, as was mentioned in the sermonette, we are getting closer to the Passover, and the Passover is a day, or a time, I should say, that certainly represents a time which reminds us to look at ourselves. And we want to look at ourselves, as the Bible talks about, with a pure heart, or being honest with ourselves, and look at ourselves through God's Spirit, because we can't see ourselves without God's help. That's why it was Christ that said that those poor people didn't know their left hand from their right hand. They didn't know what in the world was going on. They just were, they lived, they had, he said that there was all the cattle that were there in the city. Why should he destroy all of that if the people would respond? Because God is very merciful, and he's very, very patient. And I am sure that you have experienced that in the many years you've been in the church, and you've looked at things and you wish that that would get corrected. That needs to be fixed. And the answer is, yeah, it does need to be fixed. But it's in God's time that he fixes it. Now, he fixes it all right. And I've not seen him not fix it. But sometimes it takes a long time from our perspective. It might take 10 years. It might take 20 years. But what's that to him? Nothing. But it's a lot to us. If we were to say that it's going to take 20 years from now before such and such gets fixed or straightened out, we might not be here. That's a big deal to us. 20 years is a big deal to us right now. But to God, it's no big deal. So he does things in his time, and he tries to show us through these examples in the Bible how he looks at things. And I want to continue here. A while ago, I gave a sermon about part of David, King David's life, and I'd like you to go to 2 Samuel, the first chapter here. And we'll do kind of a story Bible study here of David's life, because David will be king over all of Israel. He'll be king in Jerusalem, just like he was. Well, not like he was, but in the same place he was there before. And the disciples will be there at the 12 gates, and it will be a very peaceful and wonderful environment. But he went through things in his life. He made his mistakes, and we can learn from those. But he had one attitude that was paramount, that as an example that we need to understand and we need to emulate. First of all, we're going to see in the first chapter here the attitude that he had about God's business. He didn't have the same attitude Jonah did. He had high respect for keeping his hands out of God's business. And he respected that very, very much. He didn't always understand what God was doing at the time. But he usually would find out as time went on. But in this particular case, he recognized that one factor. And then the second factor that I see was a very, very strong point from him, and the one that made him a man after God's own heart, was the fact that he, when he was corrected, when he was shown where he was wrong, he immediately accepted that. He immediately acknowledged that he was wrong, and he repented right away. And that is why God said he pulled or removed the mercy, his mercy and his grace from Saul, because Saul didn't do that. Saul immediately, when he was corrected by the prophet, justified his actions and tried to weasel out of it and to protect what he wanted to do, because he decided that was a good thing to do, even though it wasn't what God told him to do. And then when he was corrected for it, he was like, yeah, but blame it on something else, because he really still thought that what he did was okay. And so God removed him from being king, and he removed his mercy from him. But he did not do that with David, because David was a repentant individual and totally dedicated to God's way. Well, in the first chapter of 2 Samuel here, it's kind of interesting. Verse 1, he says, "Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in," and I'm not going to pronounce all these words here, "but he'd stayed in this other city for 2 days. And on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came to Saul's from Saul's camp. His clothes were all torn. He had dust on his head. He had been through it. So it was when he came to David that he fell on the ground and prostrated himself." Now, he thought he was going to get rewarded for what he was about to do. "And David said to him, 'Where have you come from?' And he said, 'I have escaped from the camp of Israel.'" Now, remember, David was leading the Jewish tribe, and Israel was still under Saul's direction. "And David said to him, 'Well, where have you come?' And he said, 'I've come.'" Now, remember, they're all brethren. They're all brothers, and they were fighting against each other. And David was the king, or was the leader of Judah, and he had his troops and so on. And they had all taken off, because Saul, in this case, was fighting against the Amalekites. And the Amalekites ended up wounding Saul and killing Jonathan. And he said, "Well," then David said to him, "how did the matter go? How did the battle go?" He said, "Please tell me." "And the people," he said, "the people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead." He's referring to the Israelites now, or Israel. "And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." So David said to the young man, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" And the young man told him, "Well, as it happened, as I happened by," he was running, trying to get out of there, "as I happened by chance, on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear." So he'd been wounded, and he was leaning on his spear, and he was really, really hurting. "And indeed, the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him." So the enemy was closing in on him. "And now when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called me, and he answered and said," or "I answered and said, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And he said, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Please stand over me and kill me, for anguish or agony has come upon me, but my life still remains. I'm still alive, but I'm going to die, and I'm suffering.'" And of course, his son was already dead, if I remember the story correctly. "So he said, 'I stood over him and I killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord.'" So he gives these things to David. "And then David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men that were around him." Now, this showed an attitude of mourning and of high respect for the person who had died, and that was, in this case, Saul. Now, Saul was anointed by God. And here is the principle. Have you ever asked yourself, why was David so intense when it came to not messing around with God's business? He would not touch anything that had to do with God's, in this case, anointing. He didn't want to have any part of it, although his soldiers were encouraging him. You know, kill him. Oh, God's delivered him into your hand. Look, God did this. But David did not accept that. And he did go as far as cutting off part of Saul's robe, didn't he? And then he apologized, and he felt bad about that, because he was still showing aggression towards this man. Now, you have to remember, he kept emphasizing, as you will see here. Let's just read this, and then I'll go on with my explanation here. Anyway, so they all showed a great remorse. And they mourned, verse 12, and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. So here their brethren had been being beaten, the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword, and the leaders died. And then David said to the young man, where are you from? And he said, I am the son of an alien, Amalekite. And David said to him, how was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Now, this is the key here. David was afraid, respected, had honor for the fact that God had anointed Saul. That was God's business. You don't mess with God's business. You don't take it upon yourself to deal with the one who God has set aside to do this job, because believe me, God will deal with it. And he'll deal with it in his own time. Let's go back here to Numbers 12 and verse 8. This was just another simple example. Miriam and Aaron, Miriam specifically, spoke out against, in verse 4. Let's look at verse 4 in chapter 12 of Numbers. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out here, you three. It says, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. And the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door, verse 5 here, of the tabernacle, and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both went forward. Then he said, now I want you to listen to my words. I've been listening to yours, criticizing my servant, and I want you to listen to what I have to say. And basically, in the next few verses here, two verses, he summarizes and lets people know, this is my business. Keep your hands and your mouth and your attitude out of my business. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. If I have something to say, basically, is what God's saying to Moses, I'll deal with him personally. Who are you to usurp my authority and start criticizing him? I know what's going on, God says. I know people's hearts. I know how to deal with these things. And he sees the form of the Lord, in other words, and he actually did, God's backside anyway. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Not that they should be afraid of Moses, but they should be respectful to God. Why were you not respectful to me, God is saying? Why were you presumptuous? Why did you think that you should, that you had the authority to jump in there? Well, David knew this. He understood it deeply. And he knew, even though Saul was trying to kill him, and that he was trying to do all these things during the time when he was with Saul, he knew that the answer, as he matured and he began to see what was going on, laid with God. God was the one who was in charge. He was the one who anointed Saul, and if anybody was going to remove him, it was going to be God. Now, did God remove him? Yeah, he removed Saul. Did he do it as fast as his David's friends and soldiers thought he should? Absolutely not. They wanted to get rid of Saul right away. Man, get rid of that guy. He's trying to kill you. And David knew that wasn't his job. He had to be patient, and he had to stay out of God's business. He had to trust God to take care of it. So he said in verse 14, and David said, how was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Then David called one of the young men and says, you execute him. And he did, of course. And he struck him, and he died. And so David said, your blood's on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Then David lamented with a lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. And then they begin to quote that. Okay, so the bottom line being that David respected God and knew that God had to be the one to do things. Believe me, I have, and I'm sure you have, been frustrated sometimes with the fact that certain things have gone on in the church of God, and God hasn't corrected them right away. And they've gone on and on and on and on. But God's works things out. And it may take more time than we think it should. Look at how long God allowed Saul to be in charge. Even after he removed him, he said, I'm taking my mercy from you, and I'm going to anoint this young man as king, and he's going to replace you. But he didn't take the throne. David didn't take that responsibility for quite a while. Well, let's see now. There are a lot of different reasons. First of all, God had to train David. He was only in his early 20s at the time. He didn't start reigning over Judah, which he did for 7.5 years. He started that when he was probably 22, 23 years old. And he started out with a small responsibility. And then by the time, as we'll see, he became around 30, God was working in behind the scenes that he wasn't even aware of. And then he was ordained king over both Israel and Judah, over the whole house. And God continued to be with him. But he did not usurp God's authority in spite of the fact that Saul, all the signs were there that eventually he was going to be gone. But he was not going to be gone until God removed him. And I have been frustrated and impatient with things. And I have also been presumptuous in the past to take certain things in my own hands. And I got, let's put it this way, God let me know about it. That's none of your business, buddy. Keep your hands off. So it's just, you just have to be patient. And when you back off and you say, okay, God, you take care of the problem, then you might be amazed at what transpires. I'll tell you this from my own experience. I have been. But it wasn't until I finally truly turned it over to God that he worked it out. And he worked it out in the best way, in a way I couldn't have done and wouldn't even have thought of. So this is a very important lesson for us. This is why it talks about not being judgmental. Christ doesn't want us to be judgmental against other people. That's God's business. Now, obviously, if people are causing trouble and division and so on in the church, then we will have to deal with that. But that's a pretty unusual situation. It does happen, and we have to deal with it if and when it does. But in the meantime, we're not people's judges. God is. And he said, you don't want to be condemning other people. That doesn't mean that you and I can't recognize right from wrong, that we can't recognize that someone else is making a mistake, and we can't learn from that. Of course we should. We don't want to be blind about it. We want to judge righteous judgment, Christ said. But when it comes to actions and trying to correct things, we have to be very careful, because God is the one who is the ultimate judge, not us. Okay, so after all that transpired in chapter 2 and verse 1, it happened after that that then here Saul and Jonathan are dead, Israel was being harassed by the enemies and going in a negative direction. So then David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Yes, go up." So he went up to Hebron. And so he went up there. He took his family and everything. And then in verse 4, the men of Judah came down, and they anointed him king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, "The men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who buried Saul." They just let him know that the men from Gilead had taken the time and the respect to bury Saul. So then David, being of the mind that he was, and how he respected God and respected anybody else who was respectful to God's, in this case, God's anointed. So David sent messengers to Gilead, and he told those people, "You are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown kindness to your Lord, to Saul, and have buried him, and now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you." And that's interesting. Kindness and truth. Remember here with Jonah? They didn't know their right hand from the left. They didn't know what was right or wrong. He wanted them to be able to see the truth. He understood what the truth was. He could see right and wrong. He could see things clearly because God had given him his spirit. But the world cannot reason. I mean, look at the society. They're talking, they're putting things up on the TV that are very, very offensive to me and to you too. And they're trying to make perversion look normal. They want you to think, oh, you can be perverted and you can be normal. It's all normal. And you have to be accepting of this. Get used to it. They're trying to get you used to seeing perversion. That's disgusting. I don't want to see that. But they keep showing it on the news and all these disgusting things because they want you to get used to it. They don't know their left hand from their right. They don't get it. Okay, so that's simple. And he wanted them to have the truth. He wanted to wanted them to understand what was right and wrong. And verse 6, "And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you," well, I already read this, "and also repay you this kindness because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strengthened and be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." And then now we begin another aspect taking place in David's life that he didn't even know was going on. He found out later, and he could look back at what we're going to read about, but he didn't even realize all this was being set up around him and preparing so that he would then be anointed king over Israel. And this is how God works in your life and my life. He certainly has. I could give you stories of how I didn't find out till much later what God was doing behind the scenes in order to work things out or protect or take care of my actions or my future that I wasn't even aware of. And when I found out, I was quite humbled and quite surprised. And it's exactly what was happening here. God's working things out. Works things out for you constantly that you and I aren't even aware of. Eventually you begin to see the results of it, but they're just the way it is. And here's another simple example. Abner, now you have to understand, Abner and Joab. Abner was the general, if you could call him that. He was the head of the army for Saul. Now, Joab had also been a military leader when they were all together. Remember, David and Saul and Abner and Joab, they were all together at one point until David had to flee and all the things transpired. So Abner stayed back with Saul. Joab went with David. at this point, Joab is the and his two brothers are the head of David's fighting men. Abner is the head and quite influential. And if I understand, there's some relationship that Abner was the son of Saul's brother, I believe. Anyway, he was quite respected. And he said he was the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army. And he took Saul's son, another one of his sons, and he brought him over to this other city, and he made him king. So in other words, obviously he had a lot of influence. And he made him king over Gilead, over all these different tribes, Ephraim and Benjamin, and over all Israel. And so Saul's son was, verse 10, 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months, so 7.5 years. Now Abner, the son of Ner, and his servants, who was now the king, son of Saul, went out from one city to Gibeon. And verse 13, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out to meet them. Now this is a rather interesting thing, because these two guys knew each other from before. So they agreed to get together with their best fighting guys, you know, their top men. This is as typical as it can be. So, and they were very, very evenly matched. So Joab and Abner agree. They sent messages, obviously. Said, look, we're going to meet by the pool of Gibeon. So one group sat on one side of the pool and one group sat on the other. Pool separating them. And Abner said to Joab, okay, instead of having a big war, let's see who's the strongest around here. So he said, let the young men now arise and compete before us. And Joab said, okay. Now these were their best fighters. Obviously, they weren't going to bring their worst fighters to this game. And it was a contest. Instead of going to war, if one group of young men had beaten the other, then they would say, oh, well, see, we're better. Well, they arose and they went over by number, 12 from Benjamin, followers of Saul's son, the king, and 12 from David's side. Each one grasped the opponent by the head, so they both grasped each other by the head, okay, probably with their left hand, and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, all 24 of them killed each other simultaneously because they were all good and they knew exactly what to do, and they grabbed each other by the head and they stabbed each other, and so they all died. 24 of them fell down, their best fighters. I mean, I'm laughing about it because this is so, it's just so dumb. So now you can, now, what's going to happen now? Here you have Joab and Abner. They're sitting there. Okay, boys, take them on. And they go, ready, set, go. And all 24 of them, they're all dead. And they're all lying there bleeding to death. And there are other men, of course, with them on both sides. And they're going, what's going to happen now? Are they just going to all go home? I don't think so. And so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, which is in Gibeon. So there was a very fierce battle that day. Boy, they all took off after one another. And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there. Joab, okay, now this is important. Joab and his two brothers. Now, I believe it's Asahel is the way it's pronounced, was fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. You know what a pronghorn antelope is? They live out in Wyoming and into Montana. And the reason they've survived for hundreds, probably thousands of years, is because they are fast. And they can outrun the wolves and the coyotes and the predators. That's how they survive. And so this guy was really fast runner. And he was Joab's brother. But all three of them were brothers. They were all there together. And so this one brother that was very fast took off running, and he was going to pursue Abner in verse 19. And in going, he did not turn the right hand nor to the left, but he just kept going after him. And Abner looked behind, and he said, "Are you Asahel?" And he said, "I am." And Abner told him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and lay hold on one of the young men and take his armor for yourself." In other words, leave me alone. But the brother would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to him, "Turn aside following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I face your brother Joab?" Again, they were friends. They knew each other. Okay, when I say friends, obviously they weren't at this point buddy-buddy, but they certainly had a lot of history together. "And how am I ever going to face your brother if I have to kill you to protect myself? So leave me alone. Go away." However, he refused to turn aside, and so therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of his spear. Not with the pointy end, probably thinking, "Well, I'll stop him." And he poked him back there. But he did it with such force, and probably this fellow was running at him with the blunt end of the spear, so that the spear came out his back. So it went right on through him anyway. And he fell down there and died on the spot. So it was that, or so it was, that as many as came to that place, they would stop and show respect where he had fallen, because he was highly respected. Well, when Joab and his brother found out about this, they were not happy people. They were also pursuing Abner, and the sun was going down, but they weren't as fast, of course. And when they came to the hill, which was before the city by the road of the wilderness near Gibeon, now the children of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner, so, and they became a unit. So they kind of made a blocking maneuver to protect him, and they were able to, and they took their stand on the top of a hill. Then Abner yelled down to Joab and said, "Cool it, stop it. Otherwise, everybody's going to die here, and it's going to be a very, very bad situation." And he said, "Stop." He said, "How long will it be then until you," in verse 26, "until you tell the people to return from pursuing their brethren?" And so Joab went ahead and said, "All right." And in essence, he agreed. In verse 28, he blew the trumpet. Everybody stood still. They stopped pursuing Israel anymore, and they did not fight anymore. And so Abner and his men kept going, and they went across the plain over Jordan and went to this other area, this other city. So Joab, verse 30, returned from pursuing Abner. And when he had gathered all his people together, there were missing of David's servants 19 men, plus his brother. However, the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin and Abner's men 360 men who died. And that's why they were running. Okay, so now the brother is dead. The two brothers that are still alive are not very, very happy with Abner at all. And they took up, in verse 32, their brother's body, and they buried him in his father's tomb in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men they traveled all night to get back to Hebron by daybreak. Now, all of this is going on, and David's not even involved in this particular battle. chapter 3, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, but David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. All right, well, as a result of that, if you begin to drop down here, verse 6, now it was so, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. So his political influence was getting stronger and stronger. Okay, so now he had more and more command, even though he wasn't the king, but he was the one who recommended Saul's son to be king. So obviously he was highly respected, and he became stronger and stronger as time went on. And then Saul's son accused him of having some improper relationship with one of Saul's concubines. And verse 8, then Abner became very angry with the king, and he said, you know, I'm a dog's head, and so on. He got that, basically that did it. When Saul's son, who he'd recommended to be the king, accused him, and there was a reason. Just like his dad, he was afraid of Abner because of the power he was gaining. And he said, let's see, verse 10, said to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah. He's quoting now what was said prior when David was first anointed as a young man. And then the king, Saul's son, said he could not answer Abner another word because he feared him, because Abner was in charge of the whole army and he was afraid of him. So Abner sent messages on his behalf to David. Okay, so now Abner says, that's the end of the game. I'm going to join up with David while the getting's good here, because we're losing and I'm having more power and I have the swing vote here to be able to get people to join up with David, and I can influence the elders of Israel to go ahead and join, and I'll be able to get a good position in David's organization if I do it this way, because he could see the whole thing was going down the sewer. But David wasn't aware of all this going on behind the scenes. All this was taking place, and all of this was happening so that David eventually would be ordained king over Israel. This is what God was working out. Circumstances which caused people to do various things and come to various conclusions and make certain decisions. And so this is what it finally took to get Abner to flip the other direction. He could have done it long before, but he thought, you know, he liked his position. He stayed with it until it was going down. And so then David accepted he said, verse 12, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you and bring all Israel to you. So David said, good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you give me Michal. This was this was Saul's daughter, who he had won in battle, according to Saul's agreement. But Saul kept her back, and he had to leave without her. He said, I want my wife back. So David sent messengers to Saul's son saying, give me my wife back, whom I'm betrothed to myself, for the 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And, of course, he brought 200, if my memory is correct. So Saul's son sent to take her from her husband. And verse 16, then her husband went along with her, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, get out of here. Go back home. And verse 16, Now, they weren't about to change their mind. Now, Abner had committed or communicated with the elders of Israel. Now, this is what he said to persuade them. Again, he's doing all this, and David's not doing anything. God is working this thing out. David's not politically moving to try to get into position. God's doing this, and he's working behind the scenes to effectuate and to fulfill what he, God, wants done and what he said was going to happen. This is how he's doing it. In time past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. That's what you wanted before. He said, now let's do it, verse 18. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and the hand of all of their enemies. So he's telling the elders, come on, let's do what you wanted to do originally. And so Abner spoke in the hearing of Benjamin, and then Abner also was able to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron. All that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. Excuse me. So Abner and 20 men with him came to David, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And then Abner said to David, I will arise, verse 21, and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So he's kind of trying to appeal to David. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Okay, so Abner agreed to go in peace. He didn't want war. He was done with the fighting. He wanted to get together. And obviously he wanted, you know, a good place in David's organization. At that moment, same time, Abner leaves. Now this other individual who Abner knew well. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid, and they brought back a lot of spoil in verse 22. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. Now, when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And then Joab came to the king and said, what have you done here? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away, and he is already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know your going and your coming in and out. In other words, know what was going on and everything that you were doing. What, are you naive, David? Don't you see what this guy's trying to do? Well, the truth was, of course, Abner really was trying to make peace because he saw his organization was collapsing. But Joab obviously was a little prejudiced since Abner had killed his brother. So that when Joab had gone from David's presence, so Joab says these things and he leaves. He sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it, so David knew nothing of what was going on. Joab did this on his own. And now he does something not very good. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, so he agreed to come back because he was showing peace, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately. And Joab's brother was with him. And there he stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of his brother right there. So he was not, you know, Abner wasn't looking for a fight, but he got him off to the side and away from his men, and he stabbed him and killed him. And afterward, when David heard about it, he said, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab. And later Joab, anyway, God deals with this situation later on, but it was quite a bit later. Let it rest on the head of Joab and all of his father's house. Now this is a pretty strong statement. and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has discharge, or is a leopard, or who leans on a staff, or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. That's a pretty strong statement against Joab's family and his heritage. He wanted to make sure people understood that he wasn't two-faced, that he wasn't underhanded, that he didn't deliberately lure Abner there and then kill him. So Joab and his brother killed Abner because he had killed their brother, and Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. And then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and gird yourself with sackcloth and mourn for Abner." And King David followed the coffin. So they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king sang a lament over Abner and said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor were your feet put into fetters, as a man falls before wicked men, so you fell." So it was a low blow, so to speak, as they say. Then all the people wept over him again. And when the people came to persuade David to eat, he was fasting, David took an oath, said, "God, do so to me also, if I taste bread or anything else until the sun goes down." Now all the people took note of it. It pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people, because David had won their hearts, and God was with him, and he gave favor in the eyes of the people to David, for David. For all the people and all Israel understood that day. They were convinced that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner, the son of Ner. Because, of course, they knew the whole history, too, because they had all been together under Saul at one point, not that long before. Then the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zerah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evil doer according to his wickedness." He did not take this into his own hands. He said, "God will deal with it." And this is another lesson that we need to remember. We have to, you know, "Vengeance is mine," says the Eternal. We have to turn it over to God, as Paul did with the coppersmith, which I thought was a pretty strong statement. "May God reward him according to his deeds." Because he knew that certainly God wasn't very happy with the actions of people, and he would deal with it, but it just wouldn't be as soon or as quite the way we would do it. So when Saul's son, who was the king, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart, and all Israel was troubled. So the other side was very, very discouraged. So now Saul's son had two men who were captains of the troops, and these two guys just were about to make another dumb mistake. So what they did is they figured, well, things are collapsing over here. We need to get over there to David's side, because we're all going to be together with him anyway. We need to get in there and get his favor and get a good job over there, because we're captains here and we want to be captains over there, or maybe better. So what they did was they went in verse 4. Well, let me see here. Well, it talks about Jonathan's son, who was lame in his feet from the time he was 5 years old. But anyway, then these two brothers go to where Saul's son, the king, was lying during the middle of the day in his bedroom. It was very hot, and he was lying on the bed. And verse 6, and they came there all the way to the house as though they were to get wheat. They stabbed him in the stomach. This is a favorite place to get stabbed, I guess. And then these two brothers took off, and they were able to escape out of that area and go across the plain, and they were able to escape during the night. And they brought the head, so they weren't happy with just stabbing him in the stomach. They chopped his head off. They brought the head of Saul's son, the king, to David at Hebron, saying to the king, "Here is the head of the son of Saul, your enemy, and you're going to reward us, right? Who sought your life, and the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day." Of course, we did it. And his descendants. And then King answered these two brothers, and he said, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity?" So he gave credit to God for protecting him. "When someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking..." Now remember, this refers back to the guy that came and admitted that he had killed Saul. "Look, Saul is dead," thinking to have brought good news, "I arrested him and had him executed." He thought not only that he brought good news, but he thought he was going to get rewarded. "The one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. How much more when the wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house, in his own bed?" He said, "What do you think I'm going to do to you? Shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" And not only did David have these men executed, but he cut off their hands and feet and hanged them by the pool of Hebron. But they took the head of Saul's son and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. So all these things were going on behind the scenes, and these people trying to maneuver to get into position for themselves. It was all greediness, and David had to deal with all of this. "Then all the tribes of Israel," chapter 5, "came to David at Hebron and spoke and said, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. And so he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years, combination of over Judah and over Israel, a total of 40 years. God gave him peace. And notice in verse 10, "So David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him." And we want to have that kind of situation in our life. We want to have God with us. And, of course, that means we have to do our best to stay close to him. Well, all these things transpired here. He went to, later on, David went to move the Ark of the Covenant. And chapter 6 here in verse 6, Uzziah put his hand out on the Ark. Now, for whatever was in Uzziah's mind wasn't obviously the right thing. And God, because he thought, well, I'll hold the Ark, and because the oxen stumbled, and then the anger of the Lord, verse 7 of chapter 6, was aroused against Uzziah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the Ark of God. And then David was like, whoa, what happened here? And so he just left the Ark of God at that place, and it was taken into this one family's house. God blessed that family very much, and after about 3 months, in verse 11, when he found out that God was doing that, David changed his opinion or his feeling there. And so then he came to move the ark. He'd already prepared a tabernacle for the ark, and he was very exuberant. And verse 13, "And so it was, when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone six paces, that he sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. And then David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. I don't know what that looks like, but whatever it was, he was showing his enthusiasm and his appreciation to God for everything he'd given him. And so he was dancing with a lot of enthusiasm. So David and all his house brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. He was really celebrating and really thanking God for everything he had given him. Again, his heart and his mind was totally given to God, to support God, to do what God wanted him to do, and he was so happy to be able to serve him. And verse 16, and as the ark of the Lord came to the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, the one that he asked to come back and be returned to him, looked through a window and saw the king leaping and whirling before the Lord. Interesting, leaping and whirling before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. She just thought, boy, he's just acting like a big fool. And so they brought the ark, put it in the midst of the tabernacle. David did the burnt offerings, and finally he distributed, verse 19, among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, and to everyone a loaf of bread, a piece of meat, cake of raisins. And so all the people departed, everyone to his house. And then David returned to bless, verse 20, his household. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, oh man, you were really glorious. How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. So David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore I will play music before the Lord. I'm going to do it. I'm going to celebrate before God because he's the one who put me in this position. And I will be even more undignified than this and will be humble in my own sight. In other words, not take credit for myself or to myself. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, they will, by them I will be held in honor. Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. So, anyway, I'm going to stop right there because of the time here in chapter 7, because the next area that we get into, God makes this covenant with David, and I'll go over that later. And then I like this one thing here in chapter 8 and verse 15. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered judgment and justice to all his people. And this is something that all people want from a leader. They want honest, godly judgment, and they want true justice. And as the proverb says, when a just king reigns, the people rejoice. But of course, when the evil king reigns and he tries to get everything for himself and tries to control everybody and take from them, then the people are not happy at all there. But then the next area which we want to cover before Passover here is the story of Uriah and David's mistake, but how David handled that. And that's a very, very important principle. But I think you can see David's attitude towards God and his enthusiasm to follow God's way, and that was his whole focus. And he gave God total credit. He didn't take credit for himself. And I don't know if you remember the film Patton, but when they were marching, they were doing all this conquering, and everybody eventually, talking with some of the guys from the Second World War, everybody wanted to be in the Third Army because the Third Army was kicking butt, as they say. And they were heading for Berlin. And they were winning. And everybody wants to be on the winning side. But one of the things that the actor that played Patton said when he was recalling some of the history that he had studied. He said when the Roman kings or the Roman generals would come in after a battle, and they would be parading through the arch, and all the people were cheering, and they were in the chariots, and they're saying, "How great you are, how great you are." There was always this little guy standing behind him, reminding him that you're only a human, that you're not that great. Don't get the big head. Interesting. And David never did that, because it's a human tendency. You begin to look around after you've won the battle, and you go, "Well, I am pretty good. Not only am I not pretty good, I know I'm good." And then he starts taking credit for himself, and then you end up like Saul, doing the wrong thing, because you start thinking you're smarter than David, or than God, I mean. And that's when you get into big trouble. We aren't smarter than God, and we have to be always in a learning mode, and always honestly, out of a pure heart, looking at ourselves. So that's what to be praying for, is that God will help us to be honest with ourselves and help us to see our real motivation, so that we can always be turning towards Him in a repentant attitude and be under His mercy, because we don't want God to remove His mercy from us.